This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. From 1984 and Brave New World to The Hunger Games and The Walking Dead, stories of totalitarian societies and plague or environmentally ravaged worlds serve as both entertainment and warnings of what could be. A recent international conference, His Master's Voice, held in Krakow, Poland, explored the latest representations of utopian and dystopian worlds in today's culture. Kevin Grace, head of the University of Cincinnati Archives and Rare Books Library and an adjunct assistant professor, was one of five Americans to give presentations at this conference. And he joins us to discuss how dystopian novels and their graphic and movie adaptations portray authoritarian government authorities' fear of the power of knowledge. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kevin, good to see you this afternoon.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Give us an overview of this conference you attended. It sounds fascinating. His Master's Voice.
It's an interesting conference. It was put together by a group of faculty who have started this institute at Jagiellonian University, which was founded in the 1300s. So they've been around a while. They get new basketball uniforms next year, I guess. But they organized this conference to bring together scholars who have a different view of dystopian and utopian literature. And my focus was on the fear of books and reading and libraries that is evident in these works of literature. Other people focused on television shows, on music, on film. So it was a nice broad range of approaches to the topic.
So His Master's Voice, that's named for a sci-fi novel, isn't it?
His Master's Voice, but they actually took it from the old RCA Victor.
Really? The dog looking into that.
In terms of this sort of unseen anonymous power that controls you. And so they took their impetus from that.
Now, how did you get invited to speak?
I'm not sure, except that people know I'll show up and I'll keep to the 20-minute time or something like that. But no, I've been doing research for the last several years on how our society is changing their approach to books and reading for positive and negative approaches to it. And so with that in mind, they wanted me to speak about that particular topic of books and libraries.
So the theme, the fear of libraries and reading and dystopian and post-apocalyptic culture. Are there got to be real-life examples of this floating around, aren't there, Kevin?
Oh, I think we see it every day. Wherever you try and have censorship by a government, we see it in China, where they try and close down certain aspects of the internet. We see it in the Middle East, where they have tried to get rid of Twitter, or control Facebook even. And really, the social media is how we're reading today in large measure among the general public. And we make a point of saying that the uprising of the Arab Spring was successful largely in part because of people reading social media. So when you try and control access to that, it's an attempt to control knowledge, control the conveyance of knowledge and information.
You know, while social media have enhanced the spread of information and knowledge, is there an impact beyond that, good or bad, on the value of the printed word and on libraries?
I think it's good. I think we have more access to books and libraries than we've ever had before. The danger is when we create surrogates for this knowledge, whether it's digitized material or not. And then we seem to forget that they are only surrogates, that we really have no means of preserving them, and that we have to go back to the analog from time to time, and we have to know the historical context.
So it's the permanency of the printed word that is its value.
Yeah, and I think people are realizing that more and more. E-books are continuing in popularity and will only keep growing. If there's any danger to the printed word, it's that e-books are going to supplant paperback books, that hardback sales will continue, that people will still want that physical book, but that in their everyday lives are going to rely on electronic reading.
So as we keep talking about dystopian writing, what exactly is dystopia? Dystopian, what's the definition of that?
I think dystopia can be defined as a reorganization of society in a negative way, to where there are only a few people who control that, where there has been a breakdown. And in order to accommodate that, there are those who control others.
Okay, so what do you feel are the most powerful and effective examples of dystopian writing, and what makes them so?
Well, probably the most familiar example to everyone is Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. It was done in the 1950s. It was done in reaction in some way to the Cold War, but also to the House Un-American Activities Committee. And in that scenario, you have firemen who are coming into homes and burning books. And in opposition to that, you have people who are memorizing books, knowing that the day will eventually come around that they can be printed again and that they can read them in safety.
And the significance of Fahrenheit 451, that's the temperature that paper burns at, isn't
yes.
it? Okay, so that's where the title of the book came from.
Right.
When that book came out, what kind of an impact did it have on society? How did people take it?
That's a good question, because we were in the 1950s and we were somewhat secure in our economy and our schools and things like that. But there was also the Cold War going on and the threat of nuclear annihilation. So we had this underlying fear. And with that underlying fear came the fear of a government, such as under McCarthyism, that would try and control what we say, what we do, what we read. So there was an embracing of Bradbury's tale, in large measure because it was well written and it was a good story, and you always have to have that above all, but also because it sort of reflected a fear within ourselves that we were going to lose some of our freedoms.
Now, what are some other examples that make your list of powerful and effective dystopian writings?
Well, I think a very good one is V for Vendetta, when we start getting to graphic novels. Mm-hmm. In that scenario, V has an underground lair where he keeps his books and keeps them hidden from people because he is preserving that knowledge. One of my favorite books of all time is Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, who was traditionally a children's writer, but this was an experimental novel where it takes place several centuries in the future, and we've lost the power to read, and the young man Ridley Walker is trying to write down his history, his heritage of his people in England, as he can spell them. And it's a difficult novel to read, but it really speaks to how, no matter what, we're going to try and preserve the written word.
Now, whether it's about the impact of a totalitarian government or the impact of an environmental disaster, is there a common thread in dystopian writing?
The common thread, I think, perhaps, is that there is a government that is trying to control everything, and then there is always an active guerrilla movement a group of people who are resistant fighters.
So to some extent, this is a warning of something that might happen or could happen.
It's always a warning, yeah. Dystopian fiction, I think, is always a warning that something like this could happen, and you best be prepared.
Now, what is it about this type of writing that just drives the authoritarian, totalitarian government crazy?
I think it's because they feel threatened that someone will know the secrets that they know, that it threatens their power base. And I think the appeal to it is to, especially when we talk about young adult literature, is that it answers their need to thwart authority in some way, to have their own culture and to not have it taken away from them.
Now, dystopian fiction seems to be a lot more popular than utopian fiction. Why is that?
That's a good question.
You know, if you create a list of the top dystopian books, it's probably easy to come up with a top 10 list. But if you say, utopian novels.
Yeah,
it's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't do my paper on that. but I think it's because it's hard for us to imagine a perfect society. There's always a monkey wrench in the works, and it's much easier for us to imagine a dystopian society becoming reality than it is for us to imagine a utopian society becoming reality.
What parts of the world are we seeing the a growth in the popularity of dystopian writing?
Oh, that's a great question. We're seeing it in Eastern Europe, and I think that might be one of the reasons Krakow was such an appropriate place for this, because they're only a couple of generations removed from a totalitarian government. We're seeing it in the Middle East a great deal. We're seeing it in Egypt in particular. We're starting to see it in other parts of North Africa. We're certainly seeing it in China.
Now, how does the internet play into this? It was easy to control access to books, but the internet's making it harder for governments to control thought, knowledge, and flow of information, isn't it?
Oh, the internet is our savior in all this. You might be able to shut down something for a brief period of time, but with the skills that people have these days, there's always a way to get around it, and it's just a matter of time before they do. So the internet is a very scary thing to totalitarian governments.
What would you say the current state of the printed word and libraries is across the world?
Gosh, that's a difficult thing to say, but I would say that in reality it's thriving. We are moving aside more printed books in libraries because there are other ways, more efficient ways to get information, but we are seeing them being held more as the backbone of our knowledge, and we're seeing them being held as cultural treasures of our heritage. So it's thriving in a way we didn't anticipate, say, 50 years ago, but it's still going to be around 50 years from now. The 21st century really for this is going to be a marriage that will continue for a long time between e-version and the print version.
So they're going to work in combination. They're going to enhance each other.
Yeah, they both have their own areas of usefulness.
Now, how does what part of your talk was about the Twilight Zone?
The Twilight Zone, yeah.
Right. How does that fit into this whole conversation? I mean, this was an interesting thing to me, that the Twilight Zone actually touched on this theme.
Right, right. Well, this conference was looking at the visual notion of dystopian and utopian literature as well. And in the Twilight Zone, it was a perfect example, again during the Cold War, of Rod Serling coming up with these scenarios where all of a sudden books were incredibly precious and we didn't have the means to read them. In one episode, he had two particular episodes, both of which starred Burgess Meredith.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was Burgess Meredith played this myopic banker who was kept from reading for pleasure by his boss and by his wife. And one day he goes down into the bank vault where it's private and for his lunch and he can read. And unbeknownst to him, there's a nuclear holocaust, and he comes up out of the ground, and everything is destroyed. Everybody is dead. He's the last man on Earth, and he goes to where the public library is, and while the building is destroyed, all the books are there, and he's ecstatic. He thinks for the rest of his life he will have the privacy and the time to read everything, and as he settles down to read, his glasses, Coke bottle lenses, falls off and shatters, and all of a sudden he's blind, and he can never read again.
He can never read, and he's got nobody around him.
Nobody around him. So it's a nightmare in and of itself. And then in the other episode, he plays this person who has maintained books and is called to account for secreting away a Bible, and he's condemned to death. And he manages to get his executioner in a room with him and threatens to blow up the room, and the man becomes afraid. But Meredith in his character is not, because he knows that he stands on the pillar of righteousness in all this, and that books will survive in one way or another.
You know, dystopian writing, Kevin, by its very nature is grim. It's taking a dark look at society. But how is it beneficial?
I think it gives us an outlet. But you know, there is one recent novel that is dystopian that is actually quite funny. It's LMNOP, and it takes place on this utopian island off of the coast of South Carolina, where they venerate the man who invented the phrase, quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog, every letter of the alphabet. Well, on his statue, where this is portrayed in tiles, letters start to begin to fall off. And so the local government decides that as these letters fall off, you can never use those letters again in any discourse or in any printed matter. And the utopian society turns into a dystopian society. But it is very funny. But in terms of the grim nature of it, I think it because it does give us an outlet. It gives us a way we can express our dissatisfaction with authority.
Is it also maybe the idea that things could be a lot worse than they are? Look at this.
Well, it's also that things might be worse than we think they are.
Okay. Yeah, some dystopian novels, there's no happy ending. But in some of the modern dystopian movies, there is a happy ending. What do you think of that?
I think it's because it's two different mediums. And when we go to the movies, we want a resolution. We don't always look for a resolution in the fiction we read. And we also have to look at the demographic those movies are targeted toward. And for young adults, they want to see Jennifer Lawrence come out ahead. They want victory. And I think it's important when it comes to the movie version of a lot of these dystopian novels that we do see that victory. We go out with the feeling that we can prevail.
Can dystopian novels actually advance the cause of freedom, do you think?
Oh, yeah, because I think they keep us forewarned. So they keep us vigilant.
Now, they keep us forewarned, they keep us vigilant. What do you think the future of dystopian writing is? Are we going to continue to see this increase in popularity and keep growing?
Well, Lois Lowry, who wrote The Giver, which, of course, was made into a movie and has been very popular and has this notion of the fear of libraries and reading, she thinks that dystopian fiction is on the downswing. It's not so much in the publishing world, except that you see more and more of these dystopian novels being done as Kindle books, which is interesting in itself, that it's taking the electronic version of publishing. And of course, when you get that, you get good and bad writing. But, I don't see it as dwindling. I see as long as we're still unsure of the future, unsure of social media, that will continue to see these. And of course, you know, we're always afraid of what's going to happen in terms of our personal freedoms.
Was there anything you came across or at the conference that came as a surprise to you?
Not really. Krakow was a very pleasant surprise, but it's also one of these UNESCO designated cities of literature. So there were bookshops and reading everywhere. And so I guess the surprise is that I was heartened by how much people are still reading.
Now, if you were going to tell somebody who's just starting into reading dystopian novels, somebody like me, I've not been a big dystopian fan, what would be your list of, this is what you should read first, do this, then this, then this? What would you suggest to somebody? How do they start that journey?
First one is Fahrenheit 451.
Okay, which we've talked about.
Do that one first.
Classic primary example of a dystopian novel?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's certainly one of the best written. And it's one of the ones most relevant to our lives. But there are a couple of new novels out. Jay, there's another one called The Word Exchange. So I think the second one would be The Word Exchange by a woman named Graydon. And that is a case where all of a sudden the word is being devalued, where there are no longer going to be printed encyclopedias or works. So I think those are a good start. One's a little older, you know, 75 years old or whatever. The other came out last year.
Is that how old Fahrenheit 451 is now?
It came out in the early 50s, so I'd have to do the math here real quick.
Getting close to being almost 70. That's hard to believe. Has this genre always been, is it been around that long, really?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you can find dystopian novels going back to the beginnings of printing. And they creep up every once in a while in the few hundred years prior to Bradbury.
So it's probably safe to say if they've been around this long, they'll probably continue to be around for years to come.
Yeah, we're not going to change our fears overnight. They're going to stay with us.
What about, we've talked about what dystopian books you'd recommend. What about on the audiovisual side, what dystopian movies, films, what would you recommend there?
I would say V for Vendetta.
Start with V.
It's a good portrayal. In terms of, I'd look at those Twilight episodes, which are available on YouTube. Those are wonderful to look at and get a feeling for it.
Now you say Twilight, the movie or the
Twilight Zone
episodes
on YouTube. And then there is a real good one called The Postman, which, You know, Kevin Costner is not the best actor in the world by any means, but he does all right in this, to where he essentially becomes this traveling bard of putting on Shakespeare plays. And it's a real good look at how we might fear people in literature. So, I'd start with those. Those are really good ones.
But we talk about it being a message about what could happen, but it's also entertainment, right? This is something that a lot of people can enjoy.
Yeah. Keep that in mind. It is entertainment. It's not something you read before you go into a bunker.
Thank you for the advice, Kevin. That's much appreciated. Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon, Kevin. Kevin Grace is the head of the University of Cincinnati Archives and Rare Books Library and an adjunct assistant professor. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Rick Andrus. I'm Mark Haney.